else would you like to go about negotiating the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, but right here in a big fat minefield? Well, Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host, helping me navigate all of this stuff. How are you, Scott?
I'm well. You know, Waleed, we do enjoy a bit of intellectual big game hunting on this show, don't we?
Yes.
It's kind of, you know, it's a limited program, and so how better to celebrate the limitations than by bringing the biggest, dirtiest moral gorillas we possibly can, just to completely confuse my metaphors. So let's kick things off by one of the biggest philosophical problems that's exercised the minds of political philosophers from time immemorial, the beginning of every serious political conversation that's worth its salt. The question, of course, what is the price of milk? Or rather, what should it be? I mean, after all, this week we've witnessed, I think, a fairly graphic demonstration of the sheer human cost of the dogma of profit maximization at the expense of producers, as a number of dairy farmers have gone public to explain just what the cut in the price that they will be paid for their milk means for them.
This is what we do. We get up at 4 o'clock every single morning, and it's our lifestyle, and we choose to do it because we're really passionate about what we do. And to have corporate come in and put us in this position is just absolutely gut-wrenching. This is our family stuff.
That's a distraught Victorian dairy farmer by the name of Beck Casey, and there have been so many of those stories, Scott. I think one of the images that has really stuck with me throughout this week has been just seeing farmer after farmer who you get the feeling have never cried in their life, you know, that sort of character. And as they slowly start to take you through what is happening to them and how they're being, in their view, drastically underpaid for their milk and driven into debt the more they sell, which is a bizarre kind of equation, you start to see them break down. And it's really telling of the human cost. The questions, though, that it raises are enormous. And the largest scale question I can think of that it raises, Scott, is the one about the very relationship between democracy and capitalism. It's no smaller than that. And that might seem a grand thing to say, but allow me to explain why I say that. Really what we're talking about when we are talking about the operation of a market in this way to the detriment of producers, there are alternatives that exist before politicians, for example, in dealing with this. We can have a big argument about exactly what measures they might be, but one of the ones that has been mentioned by farmers has been the idea of introducing a milk levy. So maybe 50 cents a litre that would go onto your price of milk and go straight to the farmers, and then they would be able to make a profit out of what they're doing, at least until the milk market changes in a way that makes it more organically profitable. That's one suggestion. Now, there was a report in Fairfax Media earlier this week. It was an unnamed source from within the coalition that said that they would not consider that because they could not bring themselves to propose a milk tax in the middle of an election campaign. Now, I don't want to overplay this. I don't know if that's the full story. I don't even know how true that necessarily is. But the question that it immediately raises is, why would that not be a politically palatable option at all? Why would that not be something that people would immediately sign up to and say, you know what, for an extra dollar a week on milk, I'm prepared to keep these farms going and keep these people's lives going and perhaps even mitigate the effects that express themselves in the form of suicide occasionally? And that really, I think, is ultimately a question of solidarity. Do you have sufficient solidarity with these producers to pay that extra dollar a week? And here is the question for democracy, isn't it, in the age of capitalism, Scott? If capitalism is training us to think of ourselves as competitive entrepreneurs, then we become less and less inclined towards feeling that kind of solidarity and giving up even the smallest element of our financial well-being for the sake of other people. In other words, that solidarity has eroded. And yet democracy cannot survive without solidarity because it requires us to give rights to one another, to people that we may not like, and we have to have solidarity to each other and to some grander social and political system in order for it to work. So is this a canary in the coal mine of some sort, Scott, that tells us that the strains that capitalism places on solidarity or the erosion that it puts on social solidarity might show up in a way that actually in the long, long run makes democracy either unsustainable or much more difficult to sustain?
Well, Ed, you're talking my language. And I mean, you know, it'd be easy for me to say, yes, absolutely, as always, I agree with everything that you just said. But I actually think you've underplayed it. I think you've massively undersold both the extent of the problem, but also the possibilities for the solution. Let me just say, for instance, that I don't think that the real problem within sort of capitalistically determined times, times that have been slowly eroded away by the logic of capitalism seeping into even our most basic fundamental social relationships, I don't think the problem is that we've all been turned into entrepreneurs. I think the problem is we've all been turned into consumers, that we've gone from being political citizens with all of the vocations that citizenship demands, that sense of political vocation, of social solidarity, but also of the obligations we have one to another. So I think it's not so much we're entrepreneurs, but rather we're consumers, and we're encouraged to consume political products. I think this is what you then see at election times. That
You see it at budget time especially, don't you? Where every budget is reported on who wins, who loses,
exactly.
What do you get out of this budget? Yeah.
That's exactly right. So I think that would be the one slight qualification. I know that's not sort of contradictory to what you've said, but I think that's an important qualification. The other thing
I've made before. Yeah, I understand. Yes.
Why is it that we then rely, that we fall back on state solutions? That's my other great problem. I mean, if you think of the logic of things like, for instance, economic or financial regulation, regulation is what you need within a capitalist economy when you can't trust people not to screw one another. I mean, that's a paraphrase, if you like, of Adam Smith.
Yep.
Regulation is what you need when certain basic citizenly virtues have disappeared and the social bond within which market relations had been embedded no longer exist. And so why do we need a milk tax, for instance, when there could be a principled decision on the part of consumers to pay a little bit more for something that registers their value? That value isn't the taste of the milk or increased calcium or some sort of flavor that's added to it, but that value is the knowledge that by paying more for this milk, I'm expressing a vital form of neighbor love, of citizenly solidarity for someone who will otherwise be traumatized by the fact that they're being massively underpaid for the milk that they produce. I mean, one of the problems. Well, yes. And that's where I think certain forms of transparency are vitally important. But I suppose, Waleed, this is part of a conversation it seems like we've been having for years. One of my concerns is that when civic bonds erode, when we no longer feel that affective connection to one another, and when we no longer recognize that our commerce, the way which we engage in certain forms of consumption, has actual effects on the lives of real people. When that recedes from view, the only thing that we have left to fall back on is the state falling in line and making do with what it can to try to rectify injustices. I think there are a whole lot of steps that we can arrive at before we even get to state solutions.
I think that's true as a general proposition. I don't want to underplay the civic dimensions of this. I picked this particular case, though, as something that does invite a state solution, because I think ultimately it's the only viable mechanism by which we can make sure that if we do want to provide money, other than in a purely charitable way, that it will actually go to those people that need that help right now. And so I think it's really just a practical thing. But the bigger question about democracy, immediately raises a governance question, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it raises
absolutely.
A question of what the role of the state is and what we conceive of. Really, we're talking about the same thing, Scott, aren't we? It's the relationship that we believe exists between me as a citizen and the government as the representative of the state, right? And whether or not I am a citizen or I am an entrepreneur or consumer. And really, I would just say they're two different sides of the same coin. Mm. But it is that coin that I think deserves to be interrogated. And then we have someone that will help us do that very, very well, I imagine. You're listening to The Minefield, by the way. Search for RN The Minefield if you would like to leave a comment on our website, or you can tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Well, when we were talking about, you know, who could we get in the studio who will help us work out the moral dimensions of the price of milk, there was one name that came immediately to mind, and he's with me in studio here. Yanis Varoufakis is an academic economist who found himself remarkably in the eye of a financial storm in 2015 during his time as Greek's finance minister. He's now professor of economics at the University of Athens, an honorary professor in the Department of Political Economy at University of Sydney, and probably one of the few people in this country that can go me blow for blow in terms of our adoration of Aristotle. Hello, Yanis.
It's very good to be here, Scott and Waleed.
So let me just put something very Aristotelian to you straight up front. traditionally, historically, philosophically, the economic sphere and the political sphere, which is really what we're talking about mm-hmm. here, the economic sphere and the political sphere were embedded with one another. Economics was a byproduct of the life of the city. That's how Aristotle, for instance, envisaged it. What we've seen over the last few decades under neoliberalism has been the gradual but quite distinct separation of those two spheres. Economics has become largely autonomous. This is then celebrated as part of the secret of our success. Certainly it is within the Australian story. Is this a mistake to separate between these two spheres?
It's not a few decades. It's a few centuries. It's capitalism that did it. You'll recall that with commodification, with the establishment of international trade routes, the filthy, vulgar merchant suddenly began acquiring economic power while having no political power and no kudos and no social status. He was despised by the powers that be, the aristocracy. That was the first time in history that you have the separation of political power from economic power. And modern society is the result of that separation. You were talking before about capitalism and about democracy. Isn't it interesting that as power has been migrating from the political to the economic sphere and then to the financial sphere, the political sphere has been democratized, a bit like the feminization of professions. So the moment women move into a profession, that profession ceases to have kudos. The same thing happens with this interesting interplay between democracy and capitalism. But let me pick a bone regarding something that you and Walid were saying before. I think that in your discussion about the price of milk and consumerism and solidarity and all that, you were following a good instinct, but I'm afraid you were barking up the wrong tree. Because this is just a case of monopoly power. This is just corporates exercising anti-competitive monopoly power over the producers. In the last few decades, since you referred before to the changes that coincide with the rise of neoliberalism, which is also, in my view, the repercussion of transformation of global financial capitalism, it is true that Wall Street was behind financialization, but it was another wall that was responsible for the price of milk. Example, that's Walmart. Walmart is the company that began the relentless drive for squashing the living daylights out of producers, primary producers, usually initially in the United States, but very soon after that, everywhere else. And this attempt of corporate power to become more concentrated and to destroy the infrastructure of the primary producers, this is what you're seeing now in Australia as well. So it's Wall Street on the one hand and Walmart on the other.
Well, and here, of course, it's not really a monopoly, it's an oligopoly, I suppose.
Oligopoly has monopoly power.
And it begins with the supermarket chains having a price war about milk, and it filters through ultimately, and farmers are in this unusual position of having a product that they sell at a price that is determined to them rather than the other way around, which
The solution to this is not to introduce a tax on consumers. The solution to this is to introduce a minimum milk price. This is what you do when you regulate. So when when they privatize electricity generation and so on, they slap a maximum electricity price.
The point I wanted to make, though, is not so much about
milk, the price of milk.
Sure, but the point I wanted to make is not so much about the case of milk and whether or not a tax is an appropriate thing. It was more about the reluctance to consider something like that because of the political consequences of it. And the fact that there would be conceived in someone's mind that there would be a big political price to pay for proposing something like a levy or for committing to something like a levy is the thing that interests me far more than the question of what would actually be the best policy response here. It's the fact that we seem to have maneuvered ourselves into a position, into a corner, where the citizen as consumer is not prepared to give up a red cent for somebody else, which undermines the entire basis of taxation. And that is what I think. I mean, you say this goes back centuries. I do think this is a decades-long thing rather than centuries, because it's true economic and political power have been separating over centuries. But neoliberalism as that more modern phenomenon is really about the narratives that govern our lives. It's about the market, not as a phenomenon or as a mechanism for economics, but as a political ideology in its own right.
Well, let me add to what you're saying by, again, using an example from Walmart. If you walk through the aisles of Walmart in the United States, and I used to do that when I lived there because it was just it was just a show of horrors to see what was being sold and at what price it was being sold. You know, I noticed there was a 1 gallon jar of pickles. Now, who would want a 1 gallon jar of pickles? I don't believe that they would fit in a fridge, actually. It's a culturally significant product, and I think that this speaks to the ideology of cheapness. So, in the United States, the era of neoliberalism that you refer to begins sometime in the late 1970s with a shift from the Bretton Woods system to what I call, in a previous book of mine, the global minotaur, I used to call it, a transformation of world financial flows. The United States, after the war for 20 years, was a surplus country recycling its own surpluses to the rest of the world and stabilizing capitalism. After the 1970s, it did the opposite. It operated as a vacuum cleaner, sucking into the United States the net exports of everybody else, deficit in its current account, and financing it through sucking into Wall Street also the profits of the capitalists from Germany, Japan, China, and so on and so forth. But to do that, they had to keep wages very low in the United States. So you have, this, today the repercussion of that is blue-collar workers voting for Trump. But from the 1980s, 1890s onwards, this stagnation of wages and the diminution of the wage share in the United States was also the incentive for companies like Walmart to create the ideology of cheapness. And I have a very unsubstantiated theory I developed when I was walking through the aisles of Walmart, that the exploited, downbeat, depressed American blue-collar worker, when they get their hands on a jar of 1 gallon of pickles, even if they have no room for it in their fridge and no use for it on their plates either, at their dinner table, they still feel that they managed to expropriate part of somebody else's labor, some other blue-collar worker's labor. So this is the working class being turned against itself through the power of consumerism.
It's hard to underestimate, or it's hard to overestimate, I beg your pardon, the significance of Bretton Woods as a form of, if you like, a sort of radical post-war solidarity, the realization that the prosperity of each nation in the wake of the war really depended upon the prosperity of each other nation. So there was a kind of willful self-sacrifice, if you like, of momentary national interest. But Yanis, one of the things that's always struck me is that in so many ways, the very possibility of an international agreement like Bretton Woods was already created domestically by the forms of wartime solidarity and massive sort of post-New Deal welfareism. There was already a realization, or there's a rediscovery, if you like, of the necessary social bond that needs to exist in the forms of sacrifice and beneficence and generosity that need to accompany a nation in times of crisis. I just wonder, you know, now that domestically, if you like, neoliberalism has had its day, and that social bond, if you like, has been eroded, is it any wonder that something like Bretton Woods today is almost inconceivable?
Well, my last article was called Imagining a New Bretton Woods, so I don't think it's inconceivable that it is difficult to imagine the powers that be, the G20 and so on, gathering in New Hampshire somewhere and coming up with a new Bretton Woods. You're quite right on this. But let's not romanticize the past. What happened was the New Dealers were men, usually men, actually, exclusively men, who had been through the grapes of wrath. They had been affected in their bones by the experience of their parents being bankrupt themselves, having to live in a hard way before rising to power in the late 1930s and early 1940s, and running the war machine as a centrally planned economy, and then inheriting a global capitalism which was in a state of collapse, a Europe that was in ashes, and having to prevent another Great Depression from coming back. So necessity bred Bretton Woods, and also the fear of the Soviet Union. The two went hand in hand. So you had the malignant part of it, which was the Cold War mentality. Without the malignancy, the beneficence that you refer to would not have grown. So people like Forestrel and Acheson, who planned Bretton Woods, would not be able to push it through through Congress if Congress could not be motivated to do it in order to defeat the Soviets. But nevertheless, you are right. It was, and actually, I don't see it as a case of solidarity. It was just enlightened selfishness on the part of the Americans. They saw that the only way of preventing another Great Depression hitting them, when the factories, the gleaming factories of the 1940s that were producing aircraft carriers and jeeps and bullets and machine guns, would stop producing those, the great worry was, what would they be producing? Even if they could be converted, as they were converted, to producing white goods and cars and all that, would there be sufficient demand from the United States for all this stuff? And the answer was no. So who would be buying those? The answer was the Europeans. But the Europeans have no money. Well, we have to give them the money. So, you know, one thought led to the other, and you had the hegemonic Bretton Woods system. You know, thinking of those thoughts in Europe, I just can't believe that I come to the conclusion that I never thought when I was a young man that I would come to such a conclusion that, you know, I so wish Germany became a hegemon.
Right.
Because it's not. They're confusing hegemony with authoritarianism. They're not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good point that you make. And the point about enlightened self-interest, I think, is in some ways that's the best we can hope for at this point, although climate change might provide a counterexample to that. But it raises the question, really. A lot of what we've been speaking about is about the nature of the human beings that are gathering around these issues to try to solve them. And if they're entirely self-interested, if they're entirely consumer-driven or entrepreneurial or whatever it might be, then some of these things start to become very difficult to fix at a systemic level. And I know Scott would care about this because Scott cares a lot about the concept of moral formation within people and this sort of ground-up idea of solving our problems through that moral formation. What do you think, Yiannis? Do you think that what sort of moral formation is required? What sort of people do we need if we're genuinely going to respond to the savage or the ravages that capitalism just inherently and automatically and systemically creates?
We need people who have a capacity to say, I've had enough. And to question.
We have lots of them, and as you say, they're voting for Trump.
Yes, I know. But you see, this is the problem. When you reach the edge of a precipice, at that point, you have the best and the worst rising up simultaneously, like we did in the 1930s, and like we're doing now. In the United States in particular, there is, you know, on the one hand, you have Bernie Sanders. On the other, you have Donald Trump. And Trump appeals more to the people who feel cheated and exploited, who were stuck in the rut of very low wages and having to suffer the Walmart effect, who were given the hope of becoming rich through financialization, through getting a mortgage and buying a house and then selling it again and all that. And then they lost everything in 2008 when the subprime market collapsed. And they are the ones that tend to verge towards neo-fascistic attitudes. In Germany, the same thing happens with those who saved, and now through negative interest rates, they're seeing their pile of savings shrink. On the other hand, you have Bernie Sanders, who is appealing to discarded youngsters, to people in under 40 who have been well-educated, they are in debt as a result of it, and who are discarded. They're very creative people, but they can't convert their creativity into exchange value in a capitalism which simply doesn't have time for them. They're too indebted and too expensive and too well-educated while the machines are rising. And they are forming the kind of moral disposition that you're referring to.
Yeah, I would love to keep talking. I wish this program went for 2 hours because we would not even begin to exhaust the conversation that we could have with you. It's been such an honor for us to have you in the studio with us. Thank you so much for dropping by.
It's a great pleasure.
Yiannis Varoufakis, an academic economist with Greece's former finance minister, I should say. Scott, now go.
Well, yes, we'd love to hear what you all think. Of course, you can leave us a comment on the website. You can search for us at RN The Minefield. We'd also love for you to follow us on Twitter. Just look for us at RN The Minefield.
We look forward to hearing from you on all of those forums, but we'll see you next week with some more stuff.
to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.